The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Ross, Judge Ead, the Honorable John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Zoom edition of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We will be hearing an argument in one matter today. The appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your opening argument, and then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And respondent, you have 15 minutes for your argument. When you are not arguing, please make sure you're muted. But beyond that, it's the typical procedures of a in-court argument. So I'll ask the marshal to call the case.
Now calling case A23-1859, Shemaine Kamara March versus William Frank Schmalstieg.
All right, and with that, appellant, when you are ready to proceed, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is John Burns and I represent the appellant, Dr. William Schmalstieg. Respondent filed for an order for protection on her behalf and on behalf of the party's minor children on January 11, 2022. Prior to the evidentiary hearing, a stipulation for order for protection was set was entered voluntarily, and it was set to expire February 1, 2023. On January 25, 2023, respondent filed an application to extend the order for protection. This application was sworn under penalty of perjury and filed by her attorney. The application was denied on January 26, 2023, when the court found that the request for an extension lacks merit as it fails to include any incidents that have occurred since the OFP was issued, and therefore it was appropriate that the motion was denied. Respondent did
do,
not.
Do you agree? Can I ask you at that point? Do you agree that the petitioner before the district court, who's the respondent on appeal,
yes,
was entitled to a hearing because the ex parte motion was denied?
Yes, I do. And that was my point, is that the petitioner at the district court level, respondent here, did not ask for a hearing on that denial, nor did she seek an appeal. Instead, on January 30th, 2023.
Do you need to ask for a hearing under the statute, or are you entitled to the hearing as a matter of course?
She would need to request the hearing. This was in Hennepin County at the time. That is their procedure, that there's a request for a hearing that can be made after denial.
And if she had requested a hearing, she would have received one under the statute. You agree as a matter of course?
I do. And then the court would have reviewed it from that perspective of whether that denial that was decided by the district court on the first application was appropriate or not.
But wouldn't it, so I guess my question is, wouldn't the evidentiary, what would the difference be between the evidentiary hearing that would have occurred had she requested it at that point and the evidentiary hearing that actually occurred later in the case?
There would have been the decision of the district court referee, as affirmed by the judge on that the burden had not been met. And it would have been based on that first application. Remember that she turned around and had a second application, different facts, different presentation. So it would have been based upon the document prepared by the respondent here on appeal and her lawyer, not the document created 4 days later by an advocate who interviewed and listened to her.
But are there material factual differences between the initial application and what evidence actually came out at the evidentiary hearing that ultimately occurred? And my understanding was that there were no new allegations that had occurred since the initial OFP was issued, and that remained the same even through the evidentiary hearing that occurred. Is that wrong?
Somewhat. The evidence as presented in the first application, there were different points of emphasis. There were different details provided in the second document. Even the respondent herself said, when I had her on cross-examination, I would have put different things in there if I had been, you know, putting together my application.
But points of emphasis and details aren't, I mean, you would agree, aren't the same thing as, you know, allegations of different acts on different dates, right? I mean, I guess my question is the evidence that supported the ultimate grant of the OFP extension following the hearing that ultimately occurred, is that evidence materially different, referring to different conduct than was in the initial application? And the reason why I'm asking these questions, I'm wondering from a harmlessness perspective, if ultimately the respondent on appeal, petitioner before the district court, ended up presenting the same evidence that would have been presented had that evidence been presented after the first application for an extension was denied,
right,
then what is the harm? What's the prejudice to your client?
I understand. Yeah, the evidence that was contained in the second application was substantially different than in the first application. There was a different recitation of allegations. There was a different presentation of how it was stated.
I'm talking about at the hearing, though.
Second application. The second application was also substantively different.
But my question is the facts that came out at the hearing, the evidentiary hearing. How are those? Can you just highlight some of the main material differences between those facts and the facts of the presented in the first application?
I don't have the actual documents in front of me, but what my recollection was that the court limited the testimony to what was contained in the application, and that's more of a due process issue for my client. You can't put an application and then add more allegations when you get to court, and so the court held to the allegations that were in there. But that second application added stuff and changed things from the first application that had been denied. It was literally a second bite of the apple. You didn't like my evidence the first time. I'm going to put this evidence in instead. And this idea that it's harmless is also not accurate, because if they had been held to their first document prepared by the respondent on appeal and her lawyer, then there would have been no legal basis to extend the order for protection.
What's your authority for that? That there would be no legal basis to extend the order for protection? Because your counterpart, I think, reads the language that you've relied on more broadly. Let's see, the case that you cited says in particular when there are new facts, but that's...
Here's what I would rely upon. Thank you. So the error of law is when they did not require the sworn statement. And the showing that had to be made by the respondent was a violation of the order for protection. Don't have that. The reasonable fear of harm, that now a year later with no contact and everything else, that there's a reasonable fear of harm, an act of harassment or an incarceration and release. So that showing had to be made. And the document prepared the second time was insufficient to do that, because it was not a sworn affidavit. It was a document prepared by an advocate who did an interview, who never reached back out to the respondent on appeal and said, are these your facts? Is this what you want me to submit? It's not a sworn declaration. It can't be relied upon at all.
But what's your? Oh, go ahead.
If that's the procedure which is typically used in Hennepin County, and we were to agree with you, does that make all of those applications prepared by a advocate invalid?
No, not at all. The advocate. Ms. Allenson, in her responsive brief, goes through a detail of what she says is the domestic abuse process and procedure. They didn't follow it in this case. What they're supposed to do is they're supposed to get a verification that I've interviewed you, I put this together for you. Is this an accurate statement of what you have? And are you giving me authority to affix your signature and to put this in? That's their procedure. That's also the procedure that's set forth in the rules adopted by the judiciary for orders for protection, that there's supposed to be that verification process. That's what didn't occur. And that didn't occur in this case. But that is an expectation. What is stated in the responsive brief is, I told them, for instance, that I had made a first application that had been denied. They didn't include that. And then there's also a statement of, I never got a chance to review and verify what got filed on my behalf. And that's the critical error, is that the document, the second document provided, is not a sworn declaration. Respondent here on appeal never even got to see it.
But the statute doesn't use that language. And in subdivision 6A, it says that it just says the court may extend the terms of an existing order, or if an order is no longer in effect, grant a new order upon a showing that, you know, in your brief, you say, you know, this is your, I think this is your reply. You argue that, the, if a, that 6AB requires that a petitioner seeking to extend the terms of an existing domestic abuse order must include in the application a showing that she is reasonably in fear of physical harm from the respondent. Nowhere in 6AB does it say in the application that's where the showing needs to be made. And right, the legislature, as your counterpart points out, clearly knew how to be specific about what needed to be in the petition for an initial OFP by saying that an affidavit was required. So why should we read the words, you know, that you want us to read into the statute, that the application must include a showing, when the statute only says that the district court gives the district court discretion to extend the terms of an existing order upon a showing, which could be made, as your counterpart points out, at the evidentiary hearing, could be made in an unsworn submission. Why should we read that language into the statute?
I do the statutory analysis. I think it's pages 4 and 5 of my brief. But it just to generally answer your question, the legislature intended to require this result. So had the legislature intended to say, if you're just seeking to extend it, I don't need a sworn declaration, or I don't need an affidavit, I don't need a showing. If that was the intention, then the language would have said that all petitions under this section don't need that, but it says under the entire statute. So the specifics of the statutory construction are laid out in my brief there, but the choice of the word that they say for this statute identifies that there was an expectation, if you're going to be extending an order for protection and making one of these findings, it has to be your words, and you have to swear and verify that they're accurate, and it has to be your affidavit.
Didn't she swear and verify that the information was accurate when she was placed under oath and testified at the evidentiary hearing? And why should we read petition under subdivision 4 to be the equivalent of application under subdivision 6A, when subdivision 6A doesn't use petition at all within that subdivision?
And what I point out in my brief is that petition and application are used interchangeably in the statute. And I give examples in my brief of that, so that they are used interchangeably. To answer the question of why can't she just fix it when she gets to court, that's an impermissible expectation that my client can get pulled into court on a request to extend an order for protection for 2 years, on a request to find that there's been a showing made that compels him to come to court when it was denied the first time, and when the second time she didn't even look at, verify, or authorize the terminology that was provided. No third party can take that right of a petitioner at the lower level to seek that relief, or to use their examples and their words. I would respectfully say that that's not something that you can say, we'll just figure it out when we all get to court. It has to be done. And if you don't meet the burden, if you don't pass that preliminary ex parte requirement,
but I could see that there would be some prejudice if the allegations in the second application were materially different than what she testified to at the hearing. But she did, maybe she didn't use the exact words that were used in the application, but she didn't say when you examined her about that and when she was questioned in court that the information in the application was wrong, right? So it was not as though you had a trial by ambush on what was going to be the evidence. So maybe you can speak to what the prejudice was that
she
should
did
compel us
say,
to rule in your favor. What did she say?
Yeah, she did actually say that it was wrong. She says that's not correct. I would have said something different. I would have put different things in there. That is part of the record, that she would have presented it different, that's not how she would have said it. For those reasons, I'm asking for those and the other reasons set forth in my brief, I'm asking that this matter be reversed and remanded back so that the extension can be vacated. Thank you.
Although your time has expired, if I could, Judge Schmidt.
Yeah.
So do I understand correctly, Mr. Burns, that the challenge here is entirely procedural? You're not making any substantive argument that the testimony that was provided ultimately at the evidentiary hearing was insufficient to support the extension.
That is correct. I am making procedural arguments as to how we got into court, and I'm making procedural arguments that this matter should not have been allowed to get a second bite of the apple, to use my term.
And so the upshot would be, if we were to agree with you that this would merit reversal, I'm trying to play this out. Nothing would prohibit, if I understand correctly, Ms. March from pursuing an OFP 5 minutes after we issue the opinion.
Well, she's done that once. She could do it again. I mean, if it is reversed,
and we presume that the support would be the same support that was in her testimony, and that the evidence you're hearing would include the same evidence, and the same result would occur.
The evidence would be balanced by the district court at that time. And again, she has to show at the time of her application, so it would now be 2024, 2025, that she reasonably fears for her safety. And so that was the entire crux of where we were at last time. We had a divorce action that was just...
Oh, right. I understand all that, but I'm just in the context of the divorce action and the conduct that had occurred before the divorce proceeding and the parties were separated, and the evidence that your client hadn't changed at all and hadn't taken into any account the chemical issues that apparently were motivating or at least contributing to his hostility, the result would be the same.
No, I respectfully, I don't think it would be, because now we've had the passage of almost another full year. The divorce has been completed. Steps have been taken. And that present, I have a reasonable fear of harm, is a present reasonable fear for harm that she would have to establish with any new application. And I don't believe that the result would be the same. We've had no contact whatsoever between the parties that I believe would justify that kind of a showing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Ann Allenson. I'm attorney for respondent in this matter, Shemaine Kamara March. Appellant seems to rely on res judicata principles, but not the actual doctrine of res judicata, and then the clear language of the act itself as far as requirements for application for extension. The Domestic Abuse Act was enacted to provide an efficient remedy to domestic abuse victims, not to create an onerous process where cases are dismissed over procedural defect alone. And in practice, that efficient remedy is to get cases quickly to evidentiary hearing, where both have the ability to be heard. In this case, the district court correctly found that an application for extension isn't required to be in strict sworn affidavit form under 518B.01, subdivision 6A, and that the process followed by the district court and the domestic abuse office and followed by respondent met those statutory requirements. Appellant claims that there were some changes between the first and second application. That's just not true. They're substantially the same. Certainly they were written at different times and by different people.
Can I ask you a question? Do you agree that your client would have had the right to appeal from the denial of the first application?
She would have had the right to appeal according to, I think it's the Briggs case, Steves and Briggs, but both those cases were addressing matters that had gone to trial, not ex parte orders, not applications for extension.
How would she have had the right to appeal if we agree with your argument that the denial of the first application, the order denying the first application, was not a final judgment on the merits? Because isn't it necessary for there to be a final judgment on the merits unless some other extraordinary doctrine applies? Or a partial final judgment, or some collateral order doctrine applying, wouldn't that be necessary for your client to have the right to appeal?
Yeah, both Steves and Briggs talk about domestic abuse or matters under the Domestic Abuse Act being special proceedings, and that that would allow appeal of any order under the act. However, they say that it wouldn't be. What was the term? I mean, it would likely to be moot and wouldn't be substantive on the ex parte order. I mean, what she would have had to appeal was the ex parte or the dismissal of the ex parte order and the failure to schedule an evidentiary hearing. So what she then did at my direction was go talk to the folks at the Domestic Abuse Office because they know more about what procedure, what steps to take, next steps to take. I hadn't had an order for ex parte order for protection denied. So that's what she did.
Do you agree that had she demanded an evidentiary hearing at that point, or do you agree that she was required to demand an evidentiary hearing at that point in order to get an evidentiary hearing under the statute, and that her failure to request the evidentiary hearing justifies the court's denial of an evidentiary or neglect in setting the evidentiary hearing or denial of setting the evidentiary hearing?
So she went to the domestic abuse office looking for the next step process, and whether that was a motion or a letter to the court or a phone call to the court or a second application, which was what was recommended, that was her process of getting that evidentiary hearing scheduled. She wasn't going to the domestic abuse office trying to do anything other than get some assistance in getting that hearing scheduled. And that's where the second application came, through that recommendation of the Domestic Abuse Office.
And one other last question, and then I'll stop. But I just was wondering, is it your position that even though an order in a special proceeding may be appealable, that doesn't make an order in a special proceeding a final judgment on the merits for purposes of res judicata?
Yes, yes. And I think that the Briggs case and the Steves case support that well, under these special proceedings, these ex parte orders, for example, may be appealable. Whether or not it would make sense for somebody to appeal, is the question. And it doesn't make sense in an ex parte order, as the court pointed out. My client could return upon denial of that hearing. She can return to court and file another application. And get into court and get that hearing scheduled. Should she do a parallel track where she's then also appealing the ex parte denial or the denial of the ex parte order, it wouldn't make sense, wouldn't be effective. And by the time that denial of the ex parte order came up before this court, it would be moot because she would have likely had her evidentiary hearing, and it, then the matter would have been heard on the merits.
Does the statute require the ex parte applicant to request a hearing? I understand what happened here, that she went to the Domestic Abuse Center, but back to Judge Eads' original question, just does the statutory language require the applicant to request a hearing?
It doesn't. In fact, both Subdivision 4 and Subdivision 6A, where which governs the extension application, require that a hearing be set, but it doesn't require that she request a hearing. Again, you kind of go back to the purpose of the statute, and part of the statute is that the court is to provide forms and clerical assistance. She went in seeking this clerical assistance, and the form doesn't specifically ask for a hearing. And it's our position that the court should automatically schedule that hearing, unless sometimes petitioners and applicants will request that there not be a hearing, because if the ex parte order is denied, it puts them in danger to have a hearing scheduled and for the abuser to find out about that hearing. So that certainly is a box to be checked in the petition, in the originating petition that starts the action. But no, in the application, there's the petitioner in the OFP, the victim, shouldn't have to ask for that hearing. It should be scheduled.
This appellant's counsel points to the procedures in Hennepin County, that is the procedure that exists in Hennepin. Is there some local rule that requires the applicant to request a hearing?
So I think that just based on my anecdotal practice, I would say that varies from county to county. In Ramsey County, I would say that they are scheduled if denied the ex parte order, or if, like, for instance, under subsection 7, if the petitioner is asking for certain relief, like child custody, for example, then a hearing has to be held. But in Hennepin County, apparently that hearing is not automatically scheduled. And so that was the reason that Dr. March went to the domestic abuse office to get some guidance from them and their particular system and what the next steps would be. And as I previously said, it wasn't to necessarily file another application. It could have been that the domestic abuse office said, sure, when your ex parte order is dismissed upon application for an extension, the next step here is that we file a motion, or we contact the clerk and schedule a hearing. That it could have been as simple as that. And what they recommended and assisted her in doing was to file a second application, which is allowed or isn't prohibited per the statute.
Can I just ask, so in the first application, do I understand correctly that your client was not seeking relief under subdivision 7 paragraph A, but rather was just simply seeking extension of the relief granted in the existing order?
I misspoke or was speaking broadly about the subdivision 7 hearings. In an application, you are just asking for the status quo. You're asking for a continuation of that original order for protection. And so even though the original order for protection on that first petition, you're on the petition, may result in custody, parenting time, support being set. The extension doesn't require that a hearing be set based on, I'm not describing this well, based on the past or the originating order for protection. And so in that regard, no, a hearing wouldn't be set unless it's requested by respondent.
Right, but not generally speaking. I mean, specifically in this case, did the first application to extend the OFP seek relief under subdivision 7 paragraph A?
Not new relief, no. It would have just been extension of the order for protection currently in place. So she wasn't, I suppose there could be a circumstance where a victim just had the protective orders in place and then in the extension was asking for relief regarding support or parenting. And then that would, I would propose, would automatically trigger a hearing as well.
Can you just point to follow up on Judge Schmidt's question, point us to where in subdivision 6A then, if your client in the original application wasn't seeking new relief under subdivision 7 paragraph A, where the statute requires the court, without your client requesting a hearing, to set a hearing if the court denies the ex parte application to extend? Where is that contained in subdivision 6A?
Just so I'm clear, you're asking at what point in the extension application process would 7 be triggered?
I'm not asking about 7, because as I understand your last answer, you just said that the first application to extend the OFP didn't ask for any new relief under subdivision 7A. So as I read 6A, the last sentence begins, if the petitioner seeks only the relief under subdivision 7, paragraph A, a hearing is not required. Unless the court declines to order the requested relief or respondent requests a hearing. If a hearing is required, subdivisions 5 and 7 apply to service of the application, ... So I just want to know exactly where, because your answer to Judge Schmidt earlier was, if the court denies an ex parte application to extend the OFP that just is asking to extend the same relief that was initially granted in the original OFP, then your client didn't need to request a hearing, and the statute required the court to set a hearing without a request by your client. And I'm wondering where in the statute you're getting that, or what you're relying on.
Well, so if the petitioner in an order for protection, she's approaching the court, she's asking for an extension of the order for protection that is currently in place. The court has the option under subdivision 6A to grant that order ex parte and then require, and then the respondent has the opportunity to request a hearing. I would read that second sentence that references subdivision 7, that there is no hearing request required on that application unless she requests new relief that's not in the originating order for protection. And that if the court declines to issue that ex parte order, so the relief that she's requesting is an ex parte order, if the court declines to issue that relief or issue an order giving her that ex parte order, then she has to have a hearing. So the court can't effectively dismiss her application without a hearing.
That would seem to me to indicate that your client was requesting relief under subdivision 7A in the application to extend.
No, she wasn't asking. She was asking for an extension of the order as is. She didn't ask for any new relief. It's just that she reapplied because she didn't get the hearing as required. So yes, if there is no hearing required, you can ask for an extension. The court can grant that extension ex parte. The respondent is given notice. If he or she wants a hearing, they can then ask for that hearing. Otherwise, the ex parte order remains in place for 2 years. If the court reviewing the application denies that ex parte order, then they have to schedule a hearing, because as I said, otherwise the reviewing court is essentially dismissing the entire application and petition based on that ex parte request. So they need to be heard at that hearing.
All right. Counsel, I think your time has expired. Unless there's any other questions from the panel. Okay. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. Although I concede that res judicata does not strictly apply here, because the denial of respondent's first application was not a final judgment on the merits, the principles underlying res judicata do apply. to prevent a second application for the same relief without at least informing the court of the prior failed attempt. Rule 3.02 of the General Rules of Practice undisputably requires an application for ex parte relief to inform the court if there was a prior application for the same relief. Respondent admits that this was not disclosed, but claims that it was not her fault. Again, she claims she told the advocate that she had tried it once before, that she was
But isn't that discretionary? What's your response to the discretionary aspect of the General Rule of Practice 3.03, which says that the 3.02, failure to comply with this rule may result in vacation of any order entered, and that was discretionary with the with Judge Gilligan?
I believe that those are the principles of res judicata. And here's where I think it falls, you know, just to put a fine point on it. Application was made and denied to referee Holly Knight. Had they wanted to say, we want a hearing on this, we'd have been back in front of referee Holly Knight and arguing the issues in front of her, ones that she had already said did meet that burden.
One other question I wanted to ask you, though, so I understand you're conceding there was no final judgment on the merits, but you're also asking us to apply these principles against a party who did not, I think, as you acknowledged in your initial argument, have a full and fair opportunity to litigate the matter because no hearing was ever had on the denial of ex parte motion.
That was her requirement to go ask for a hearing, and I disagree.
So let me ask you the same question I asked you. Where in the statute does it say it's her requirement to go in and ask for the hearing, and why shouldn't we construe, as Ms. Allenson just said, her trip to the domestic abuse office and her request for help as essentially, you know, a de facto request for a hearing? I mean, she went to a court office, right?
No, she went to the domestic abuse office. That's not specifically an arm of the courts. And what she did, what she should have said is, I've made an application. I've been denied. I want my day in court. And that could have occurred.
Where does that appear in the statute then?
It is not specifically laid out in the statute, but the creation of a brand new application clearly violates the spirit of res judicata, the spirit of any judicial officer. Holly Knight denies it. 4 days later, it is in front of referee Ogunleye. And Ogunleye has no understanding that his colleague with an office a couple of doors down denied these same requests 4 days ago. That is relevant to the analysis that any judicial officer is going to make. Otherwise, you have that clear impression of judge shopping, that I try it here and I don't get it, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to throw a whole new application because I want to stay away from that first judge who didn't like what I put in there. That is very clearly what has occurred here, and that is why I'm certain that these advocates put it together in that way, get it to a more friendly a decision maker, and that is improper. And that is,
by the time the second application got to the district court was made aware of the denial of the first application, right?
Well, in the procedural history, and this is a little complicated, we then got in front of a third referee, referee Madden, where I tried to point out those details, and what she said was, no, it's good enough. We're going to have a hearing, but I'm going to kick you over to Ramsey County. So by the time that procedurally the third judicial officer got their hands on it, it was to look at what first officer, second officer, and then her own opinion as to what should happen, and then sent us to yet a fourth judicial officer. The argument was made correct, but I would argue that just procedurally, if you disagree with a judicial determination from the first referee Knight, then you should be back in front of that person explaining and having your evidentiary hearing and trying to persuade a different decision. And to not do that, to bounce around from three different referees, is the worst kind of optics for the district court in this kind of a case.
But what I understand your argument to be, though, is that they should have had the notice at the outset. And I understand that piece. Should have had the notice at the outset that the first one was denied. But then eventually it gets to Judge Gilligan. And Judge Gilligan then is made aware that the first one was denied, asks the parties to deal with all of the issues with the denial of the first one and the applicate the new application, second one, and says, you know what, that's not, I'm not barred, this isn't res judicata, and we're going to move forward.
Yeah, and that's the error of law that we point out that we believe exists in this case, that it is an error of law, that it misconstrued subdivision 6A as not requiring a sworn statement, that sworn statement should have referred to the first effort, and that the failure to do so prejudiced my client. We should have never gotten to court because of the process and procedure that was followed. And it's for those reasons, simply to put it, respondent obtained the ex parte extension based on an application that did not advise the judicial officer that she had been denied 4 days earlier, based upon an application submitted by an advocate who did not review its contents with respondent, who did not obtain authorizations for her signature, who did not verify the contents of the application under perjury, and therefore the resulting extension is invalid. And for those reasons, appellate requests an order of this court reversing the district court and remanding the case for entry of an order vacating the extension. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and your briefs that were submitted. And I do appreciate counsel for when you were ill the other week that you gave us a call and let us know. It's good to take care of yourself and to protect everybody else from spreading that stuff around. So I appreciate that, and I'm glad we could get you back on the calendar. So with that, the case is submitted, and we will get an opinion issued within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.